Hi, welcome to the Meg Pearson Podcast, Fertile at 40. I'm your host, Meg Pearson. After many health complications due to alcohol addiction and an eating disorder that ruled my world for close to 20 years, I was told I would never have children. At 38, I naturally and surprisingly fell pregnant, and the transition from maiden to mother was wrought with love, grief, excitement, and healing. Becoming a mama was about far more than just soothing stitches and learning how to care for a tiny human. It was, and still is, a relearning of who I am and what I am truly capable of. After over two challenging years trying to conceive a second baby since, I gratefully and naturally conceived my second child just as I turned 41, after three losses and heaps of heartache. I am a doula in training, holistic chef, teacher of yoga, and a childbirth educator, and I am here to share my story because I know it's not just mine. Join me each week for unbiased convos with a no-bullshit approach to faith, infertility, conscious conception, and connected pregnancy, with birth stories, expert interviews, and personal anecdotes to help tell the story of creation. Welcome. Now let's do this. Hi, and welcome to this week's episode of Fertile at 40 Podcast. I am your host, Meg Pearson. I'm so happy to have you here once again this week, and I have an incredible episode to share with you today. Oh my gosh. I'm chatting with a woman by the name of Taya Griffin. I have to admit, I have a bit of a girl crush because she's just so much fun and a wealth of information. I could have talked to her for hours. Now, Taya is an international board certified lactation consultant with 14 years and over 1,500 hours of clinical experience helping mothers achieve their nursing goals. Having breastfed her own two little girls, she knows that breastfeeding is not easy. Both children had tongue tied. She endured countless blocked ducts and five bouts of mastitis. Just like many of us, including myself, she had periods where she doubted her body and her milk supply. But despite it all, Taya recalls that breastfeeding her children was very joyful. In today's episode, Taya shares about her extended period of breastfeeding her girls, and let me just say the age at which her two daughters weaned may surprise you, and how the natural age for weaning can be a lot later than many of us think. We also talk about a lot of other amazing stuff, including her background as a homeopathic practitioner and how she integrates her training in rhythmic movement and infant reflexes into her lactation consultant practice. Now, I have to say, this conversation was so jam-packed with info, insight, and wisdom that I actually have edited our conversation and our chat down into two episodes, one of which I'm airing today and one of which will be going live later on this year. I hope that you guys love Taya as much as I did. Here is part one, coming in hot. One last thing before we get into the conversation, I want to remind you that this podcast provides general information and discussion about natural medicine, health, pregnancy, and childbirth related subjects. The content here should not be taken as medical advice, and the content here is for informational purposes only, and because each person is so unique, please consult with your healthcare professional for any medical questions. Now, on with the show. I should have asked this. Taya, right? It's Taya Griffin.
Yeah. Right, for you.
I'm already going to be editing.
It's sometimes good to leave these bloopers in, though. It shows the true nature of the fun conversation, I think, sometimes.
This is true. So maybe we will. Listeners, maybe you're right along for this ride. I am introducing this week's guest, Taya Griffin. I'm so excited to have you on the show. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here. I'm a little jealous that you're sitting in a hot space and I'm sitting in a cold space, but I won't hold it against you.
Yeah, I get that. 99% of the people I talk to, they're like, oh, Costa Rica, this time of year, especially as you were just saying, where you are in the Toronto area, spring slush time, right?
Exactly.
So I have already given you an introduction prior to our conversation starting here on the podcast, but I would like to hear from you a little bit about who you are, what your background is, and who you're helping these days.
Sure. So my name is Taya. I am an internationally board certified lactation consultant, but it was quite a pathway to get here. My husband still thinks that I haven't quite found my calling because since I've been with him, I've had several, but I'm not going to hold that against him either. This is it for me. I am obsessed with babies. I'm obsessed with and so passionate about helping moms, you know, reach their breastfeeding goals, whatever they are for them. And please, when I say breastfeeding, I also refer to body and chest feeding. It's just a vernacular that I'm using, but I definitely do encompass, and definitely do support, many people, who do, refer to it as body or chest feeding. But yeah, this is really it for me. And it came in a really roundabout way. If you ask my mom, she would definitely say that as a child, I said I would work with babies. Mm-hmm. And I, at the time, was saying that I would like to be a doctor that delivers babies, which now I feel had my path been a little different, maybe I would have gone the midwifery route. But then I did train to be a doula, more on that later. And my husband, who was dating me at the time, said, there is no way that you could not sleep for 48 hours. You're crazy. I think it's best that you didn't pursue the midwifery track. So anyways, then I went to university in Canada, Queen's University, and I started with a psychology degree, but just had no idea what I would do a thesis in. I just, the passion, what am I passionate about? Nothing right now. So I switched into commerce, which is just so much irony in it because I'm doing the complete opposite of that at this stage. I graduated, worked for 2 years at a strategy consulting firm, but really felt that the only reason I was doing it was because it seemed to pay well and it seemed to be a job that people were admirable of, but it was absolutely soul-sucking. I met some dear friends there, but overall, it just wasn't for me. And so I decided I was going to quit my job and I traveled. I became a yoga and Pilates instructor. I first was in South Africa doing my yoga instructor's course. And I grew up in South Africa and a girlfriend of mine who was getting married, who owned a Pilates studio in Hong Kong, said, well, why don't you come to Hong Kong and open up the yoga arm of the studio? And at the same time, she was running a training course for Pilates. So I started teaching Pilates. And I still do dabble in prenatal and postnatal yoga and Pilates, which is wonderful, just as a little bundle, a little extra that I do. But then again, it seemed as though there's just more. I just wanted to be more hands-on helping people. So then I enrolled and did a homeopathy degree, which was wonderful. But I felt that at the time that I was doing homeopathy, what I really saw was clients coming to homeopathy only after. Sorry, I have a dog in the background here.
It's okay.
I see yours poking out their little snout there too. Sorry, just one second. So I saw people coming to homeopathy from a perspective of like, it was the very last hope. They tried all the things and then they were coming to see me and, you know, hoping for treatment. And sometimes we had some great results, but the best was when I worked with pregnant moms or new babies and moms looking for labor support, moms trying to figure out if there was something that they could do to help their morning sickness naturally, you know, some of their pain naturally. And then also, how do I help my babies in a way that is as natural as possible? So that is where I start to think, wait a minute, remember way back when I told my mom I wanted to work with babies? Have I come finally full circle? And then I took a doula instructor's course, or I was training to become a doula. And one of the people in the course was a lactation consultant. And she said, you know what, if you want to be a great doula, you should be really good at breastfeeding. So I actually now teach in Toronto, well, it's virtual, so really anybody can take it, and breastfeeding essentials for healthcare workers and doulas, because it was that piece that became so apparent when I started to delve more into breastfeeding, is that really sometimes the healthcare practitioners and the doulas are sometimes the first point of contact. If you have a birth doula and they're right there and they're at your birth, they can be your first step towards that feeling of confidence and that feeling of like helping to achieve the breast crawl and making sure, you know, doctors and nurses are hands off as much as possible, all of those kinds of things. And before I know it, and I actually sometimes think of like how then I just fell into observing. And then after observing, I just was taking the courses. And then all of a sudden I was taking, and then I was gave birth to my baby. And then I was with my baby at the clinic. And then I was interning at the clinic, and then I was graduating, and it just seemed so seamless. It just seemed so easy. And it just seemed so meant to be. And then I started in private practice, and that's what I've been doing ever since. I did give birth to my second baby. My babies have always worked with me. They're greatest little demonstrators when you actually have a breastfeeding baby, as you go and help a breastfeeding mom. And so that, coupled with the prenatal breastfeeding classes that I teach, which now are also virtual for the most part, and being in clinic in Toronto, it's been a great kind of, a great number of ways to help support moms. We even do now in Canada, we do OHIP covered. So virtual visits that are covered by the government. So you just need an OHIP card, which is also really, really great.
So great.
So there's no barrier, right? There's absolutely no barrier to get help from a really qualified lactation consultant. So that's really the story. Now I have a puppy, and I wish that I could breastfeed my puppy. I breastfed my two daughters. Honestly, I think it would be infinitely easier. That and diapers would also be great.
Yes.
But I breastfed my first till she was about 4 and a half, and my second till she was over 6 years old. And I honestly, when I got this puppy, I'm like, what am I going to do with the baby that can't breastfeed? But anyway, she's a good girl, and I'm managing without that mothering tool. I practice what I preach. And so I did breastfeed and really enjoy the breastfeeding experience with my daughters.
Okay. So can I ask you a bit about that? Because people out there have judgments when it comes to breastfeeding a baby past a certain, I don't know who made up the expiry date of when we're supposed to stop breastfeeding our children. And I think this is really a conversation that I've been wanting to have for a long time. And would you be willing to have that conversation with me?
Of course. Yes, I would love to. So when I teach my prenatal breastfeeding classes, I reserve the last slide to talk about Catherine Detweiler's research. Catherine Detweiler is a really incredible researcher. And she essentially did her PhD and all of her research on the natural weaning age of humans, and not from an anthropological aspect, because there are lots of reports out there of, some societies it's 4 and a half and this, and then it's this. What she really looked at actually was the non-human primates and how long they breastfed their little babies until. So what she saw was that they nursed until they got their first permanent molars. For us, that's 5.5 to 6 years of age. Mm-hmm. They nursed till 6 times the length of gestation. So for us, that's about 4.5 years. Nursed until they quadrupled their birth weight. So for us, that's 2.5 to 3.5 years. Nursed until a third of their adult weight. So for us, that's like 5 to 7 years. And then nursed about halfway to reproductive maturity. So for us, that's between 6 to 7 years. And then our immune system really doesn't mature until 6 years of age. So when she looked at this, and of course she took into account the anthropological evidence of societies where there's no judgment. There's no one saying, but he has teeth. How do you do it? Well, they stick their tongue beyond their gum line. Like, if they have teeth or not, it doesn't really matter. My daughter had teeth at 3 months. She was like that kind of freak baby where you're like, whoa, you're a freak baby with like weird teeth. And so imagine, I wouldn't even have gotten to the World Health Organization's recommendations of 6 months exclusively if I had taken that into account as, oh, I can't breastfeed you, now you have teeth. Right. So essentially what her research found was that the natural weaning age in humans, if we did not have judgment, if we did not have to go back to work, if we had people supporting us rather than judging us, is between 2.5 to 7 years of age. And definitely my first, she was 3.5 when my second came along. So I tandem nursed them for a year. And then my first, at around 4.5, she just said, I think I'm too old for Bum Bum. I don't want it anymore. Now, she had been hearing little crickets in her ears from people saying, aren't you too old for that? Mm-hmm. Well, my second, they were too tired to like say things like that anymore. And she was just, it was just before her sixth birthday where she said, I don't really want, no, I don't need it anymore. And she was so happy. She was so complete. It was like, it's fine. It's great. And of course, then I burst out crying. I'm like, no, you're my last baby. And I don't think I could breastfeed my puppy. What am I going to do? She then continued to feed once or twice after she was six. And I remember the very last time she fell asleep at the breast at night was just over her sixth birthday. And I remember it was like the saddest, most bittersweet. Like, it was like, oh, I'm so happy for you that you had such a great experience, but I'm so sad for myself. Anyways, it was so beautiful and so wonderful. So that is essentially what the research shows. And I do talk to my clients and my prenatal breastfeeding students that we do also need to do what feels right. I have some moms who, you know, their baby's 10 months old and they're just feeling so tapped out and they have to return to work and they can't imagine continuing this. And they start to feel very resentful that there are these guidelines that you should do it to 2 years and beyond. And, you know, and they're just like, it's like my children are drinking bitter milk. And at that point, of course, we must wean and we must do what's right mentally for ourselves and our babies. But there's so many moms that feel like they need to wean at a year because that's when they go back in Canada. Or, you know, people now get 18 months off in Canada. And so more and more we're seeing babies breastfeed for longer. And then during COVID, I cannot tell you how many older babies I saw, given all the evidence showing that breast milk is so important and so protective. I had so many older babies whose parents wanted to continue to feed. So it's very, very interesting.
Yeah. I think it's really, it's so interesting to me. And so, I mean, it makes so much sense in so many different ways. Now, could you talk to a couple of, or a few, if you have them, reasons why breastfeeding, because I'm sure that by the time a child is 5 or 6, it's not necessarily at all the nutrition. And they mean, of course, they're going to be building their immunity, but there's also a lot of just the connection, the sense of security, all of that stuff as well, right?
Absolutely. In fact, even with my clients, with babies who are weeks or months old, I really talk about the fact that in English-speaking countries, we talk about breastfeeding and we focus on the milk and we buy pumps to get the milk out. And it becomes so much about how much milk are we getting? And are they getting just your breast milk? And there are some societies that don't encompass the term feed in their description of the nursing relationship. So I like to call it nursing because it is about so much more than breast milk. It is about connection. It is about comfort. It is about the cholecystic kinine and oxytocin release that they get when they suck. And then that makes them sleep better and just puts everybody in a better mood, including mom. It is about mothering. For me, it was about, oh, you're hurt. Here you go. Oh, you're bored. Here you go, et cetera, et cetera. And then because I'm so fascinated about this, it's also about oral function and oral development. Exclusively or mostly fed infant that has been having an artificial nipple has a completely different face it's structurally at the end than an infant who breastfed for a long time, because the way the palate development develops, the way that the teeth develops, the way that the whole jaw develops is completely different. And it can optimize breathing and airway and all of those kinds of things. So the longer we do it, yes, the lower the incidence of disease like gastrointestinal illness, upper respiratory illnesses, et cetera, et cetera. But you're right. When it gets to 5 years old, people are like, but all those benefits, like, please. And I will say this, I honestly feel that when my younger one was, you know, 5, I often thought she was kind of just sucking on her own saliva. I was like, is there really any more milk there? Like, please. But it was about so, so much more than that. And she will come now sometimes and smell me and she will say, "Ah, you smell like bum bum." That's what they call her then. And I'm like, I could ask for nothing more than that. Honestly, it was just so beautiful. So yes, it's about so much more. So if you're enjoying it, it's not even about the milk. It's about everything else that love is.
That safe space, right? You like, you smell like that safe space.
Yeah.
Which is so nourishing. You can't even describe, I'm sure, the level of potency for our little people to maintain that as they are individuating from us at the same time, right?
Yeah. There is that level where eventually, because I have a 12-year-old, they are so separate from us. And for me, to keep her so connected to me, it wasn't selfish. We both wanted to do it. I wasn't forcing her to do it. But that connection, I will never regret it. Nah, I wish if I could reverse time, it would go back to not when I was like in my 20s, but when I was breastfeeding my babies.
Wow. Now, before we move on, and if this is too personal, you don't have to answer it, but I'm just wondering, when your child was in that 4, 5.5, 6 year old phase, what did that nursing time look like? Was it, as you had mentioned, kind of circumstantial? Was it before bed all the time? What did that look like for your family?
Yeah. So certainly there might have been, you know, "Oh my goodness, that was a really bad fall. Oh, there's some blood. Come, you let me comfort you." And they were, you know, and it really kind of calmed them down. But it was a beautiful way to put them to sleep. And I would say that I put my children to sleep for a very long time at the breast. And I get so sad because I see so many moms these days who are sold this bill of goods about how putting your babies to sleep with the breast is the wrong thing to do. You're teaching them the wrong thing. And I just want to weep for society who is giving these terrible messages, because there is so much beauty in the act of doing that. And yes, does it mean that at the beginning, when they're little, perhaps they do need you to put them to sleep? And for some people, that just might be far too overwhelming. But then, you know, you recruit the other care providers and they need to learn a method. So they shouldn't lazy out and say, "Oh, well, you're breastfeeding, so just breastfeed them to sleep." "Oh, well, I guess you feed them to sleep, so too bad for you." No, pick up the slack. I'll feed baby. You can take them and learn how to put them to sleep. So it's a whole other story. but there is something, there's just something magical and lovely about doing it. And my partner, my husband, was more than happy for me to be there to breastfeed them to sleep, because it took about 5 minutes. Whereas when he read them books, it would sometimes take him like 45 minutes of reading books and back tickles and all these kinds of things. And yeah, it was so lovely. In fact, my entire prenatal breastfeeding class that I still teach to this day, I wrote with one hand while I was nursing my older one, Amelia, to sleep at night when she was a baby. I'd be lying down, she'd be on this side, and my finger would be beep, boop, beep, boop, boop. Same course I teach now. It's crazy.
Amazing. And you had all those good hormones helping you flow with so much good information for that, sure. For the content, right? So what I would like to move on to now is I'd like to just kind of go back a little bit and talk about some of the things that you were training in while you were on this path of exploration. And I mean, obviously everything that you have done and certified in and taken on through your story can help and support everything that you're doing today, which is so, so cool. And I know that one of the things that you really looked at and did a lot of work with was rhythmic movement and infant reflexes is something that you know a lot about. And I would love for you to just talk to that, what it is, for anyone out there that's not sure. And I know that it does have an impact on breastfeeding and it's all encompassing. So if you could just talk to that briefly.
Sure. So infant reflexes are being practiced by babies in the womb. And when I speak in my prenatal breastfeeding classes about the importance of those initial and very primal infant reflexes, it's for the breast crawl. Right after we give birth, we when placing babies on our chests, can see that they have the ability, using the stepping reflex, the spinal gallant, which kind of makes them move from side to side, the rooting reflex, the sucking reflex, the palmar grasp, all these very primal reflexes, that can literally lead to a baby placed on the chest in between the breasts, bounce, look, move, push, pull, see and find the nipple and areola and actually latch on. So I speak to trying to make sure that we protect this golden hour after birth so that we can have the opportunity for our baby to achieve the breast crawl, or at the very least do their best to have the skin to skin contact. And it is baby led, but we can still guide our babies there. So my second had a heart condition. So she had to have a big monitor placed on her finger when she was first born. And so it was very tricky for her to crawl her own way to the breast, but I was able to guide her there. And how well breastfeeding goes within this first hour is actually directly correlated to how long babies go on to breastfeed for, interestingly enough. So that is kind of the initial piece that I speak to about reflexes. But then we have concerns with unintegrated reflexes that can lead to some breastfeeding challenges. And there are a series of movements. Brenna Sampe is one of kind of my mentors around rhythmic movement. She does a lot of work in this space. And I took her course. And it's essentially a series of rocking movements, lateral, longitudinal, sacral rocking, rib cage rocking, that can help infants better integrate some of the reflexes that they might not have integrated. For instance, everybody wants to inhibit the Moro or the startle reflex, where babies reach their arms up, and then what they should do is they should startle and they should bring their arms around, and their arms should rest just at their chest, and it should just be this nice integration. And sometimes with infants with breastfeeding challenges, we see that an infant is stuck on one side, on both sides. So they startle and their arms stay up and their arms stay up and they never integrate. And so what the rhythmic movement does is it helps these babies to integrate these reflexes, which can then move them into better function overall and can then move them into better breastfeeding. And in fact, some of this work is done not just with babies, but adults have unintegrated reflexes. And this work, this rhythmic movement work, is not just done in babies, but also in adults and young children that have issues with reading or writing and things like this. So one of the things that inhibits the movement of the Moro reflex so that a baby can integrate it is the use of what everybody uses of swaddles. Mm. So of course, when you swaddle your baby constantly with arms in, and I will always, you know, tell parents, use the tools that are given to you, but use them very mindfully. Understand that when you swaddle all day and all night, you are constantly inhibiting movement, and movement is development. Movement is how babies integrate reflexes. Also, hands and arms are how babies tell us that they're hungry. So it's also silencing them. So when we look at it from a breastfeeding perspective specifically, we miss all their early feeding cues. So what I mentioned to parents is to try to minimize the use of the swaddle and actually maybe try to eliminate it altogether, because a well-fed baby might not actually need the swaddle. You're just using it because you were given some for a baby shower. And it tends to be that breastfeeding goes better because, first of all, babies are waking up on time, babies are getting a lot more movement, and then we do some of this rhythmic movement and it can be very, very helpful.
Amazing. So rhythmic movement is this, and this is something that you as a, are like a practitioner that you work with babies on, or is it something you teach parents? How does that work?
Yeah. So I like to empower parents to teach, to do it themselves, because it is an exercise that you want to do with babies daily. In fact, on my website, there is a great video on rhythmic movement for breastfeeding difficulties. And it's essentially going through the series of movements. So if I notice, and it is a test that I can't always do on all babies because the nature of the appointment, usually they're an hour and a half. Sometimes you're just dealing with the challenges. But when I see babies a second or third time, or when I see older babies, and that's where you really see some of these reflexes that aren't integrated, or babies that have had a C-section, but maybe haven't had a lot of body work, or again, are restricted in range of motion, then they can't extend as well. So then rhythmic movement coupled with a stretch called the guppy stretch, where we let their head hang well back over our knees, kind of like a Pilates, like barrel, basically create a little Pilates studio with our body. And then of course, body work. So that refers to pediatric chiro work, pediatric osteopathy, cranial sacral therapy. I mean, in a perfect world, all of this would be covered by the government, because I think it would make a massive difference in how babies did, not just from a breastfeeding perspective, but just the fussy, the colic, the discomfort, the gas, the all of that kind of stuff too.
So, so amazing. And God, I'm sure we could have a whole episode just talking about all of this stuff. Now, what I would like to just rewind and touch on, because you mentioned it, early hunger signs for babies. Mm-hmm. Let's just, I mean, we're going to bounce all over the place because you're such a wealth of knowledge, and I want to get as much out of you as we can for the listeners.
So cute. Babies are just so hilarious and so cute. What we used to call it more, and it's still more commonly called this, but breastfeeding on demand, right? So now I like to call it rather responsive feeding. Mm-hmm. And responsive feeding means that when your baby speaks to you, and they will always have their own little special language. So my first was very much hands to mouth. She would wake up and she would be like a whole fist in her mouth and like frantic. My second seemed to be a little more measured in her need to be so intense to tell me that she was hungry. And she would just start licking her lips or sticking her tongue in and out of her mouth. And then I knew that she was hungry. What was really interesting is twice when I had mastitis, it was because, and there is a term called holiday mastitis, which is when other people were holding my babies at like a cottage and at a party that didn't know early feeding cues. And because they were lulling baby, like, oh, no, no. I was like, I think they're hungry. And then you don't want to be rude when they're like, no, they're not hungry. They're fine. I'm just loving holding her. And then you have a breast sensitive to this buildup of milk. And it's like, bam, right back into mastitis. Wow. So I caution anybody, like if you see your baby wants to feed and they're giving you their unique cues, take that baby, go feed them. And then that baby can go straight back to the other person's arms once you've emptied your breasts. Not that the breasts can ever be emptied. I always have to remind people they're always one third full, but when babies had their feed. So feeding cues, sometimes it can be as simple as you hearing the change of breath and the stretching. And so many, I get this question every single time I teach a prenatal breastfeeding class. So many people ask me, but if I'm asleep, how will I know? I'll have to set an alarm, right? No. The beauty, and this is, partial breastfeeding, but mostly exclusive breastfeeding. So Dr. James McKenna, who's this incredible sleep researcher at the University of Notre Dame, he did sleep studies on infants that were exclusively breastfed and their moms. So electrodes. And what he found is that when babies went into their deepest sleep, so did moms. And as babies came out of their deepest sleep and they came to be like, okay, I'm ready to feed, so did mom. And we feed, and then we all go back into this rhythm. And this is why room or bed sharing or baby sleeping as close to us as possible is so important, because what they found is moms that slept in a separate room from infants, they got 27% less sleep, because they could be going into their deepest sleep right when their infant's ready to wake up. So they're like, I just got to sleep. Why are you waking me up now? And then not only that, baby has to cry then to tell you, because that's the only way you can hear them. But because these brainwaves are so intricately linked, it's impossible to sleep through a feed. You will hear it, and you might hear it just in the the different movements and the different sounds that they make. And then you feed them right then. The feeds are much easier. And then everybody goes back to sleep. That doesn't mean to say that you're not going to still feel tired, because of course, having a newborn is tiring, and that's the bottom line. We can't have a baby and think we're not going to be tired, which I feel some parents do think that.
I know.
I'm like, sorry. I'm like, if you like, you do need to be waking up. So there's that piece, which is that very, very first language. But then there are the hands to mouth, the moving towards the stimulus. You know, you've got a little blanket over here, and then they're like, trying to get latched right onto the blanket and little things like that. So every baby, a unique set of language, and just finding what those are for your baby and going from there.
Amazing.
Thanks so much for listening. Please, if you would be so kind, I would be grateful if you could share, subscribe, rate, and review the show. Please follow the show over on Instagram at FertileAt40Podcast and share what you thought about this week's episode. Don't forget to tag us. For more info on today's show, please head on over to the podcast website at meganpearson.ca/podcast. Until next time.